It's January 1st, 2016 at Kentucky Festival.
2017!
Oh my God, so it is indeed. And this is just open discussion with the ladies. 2017.
Pretty soon life's going to be fun.
So I don't think anybody, what this is completely open. I have no particular plan whatsoever. So anything, anybody want to bring up about anything? Yes.
The open repo, you read that me and my learn how to control these symptoms and we learn how to chest. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that means.
Does it mean that
you always have your hippies on, or what?
Does it mean that what?
You always wear your
headpiece. Yeah, does that mean being chased?
Yeah.
That's one of the funniest things I've ever heard. So is your question, what does it mean to be chaste, or is your question, why are men told to control their senses and women told to be chaste? Which is your question?
Well, what does it mean to be chaste?
You want both. All right. Well, we'll do the second one first, because that was your main thing. Prabhupada actually says that unmarried women must not cover their head, although somehow we don't seem to do that in our international society for human consciousness. Well, when Prabhupada means unmarried women, he doesn't mean divorced, widowed women. He means somebody who's still being protected by their father and hasn't had a relationship with a man. That's what he means by unmarried women. But he says they must not cover. And he says covering the head is a symptom of a married woman's shyness. But anyway, married women are only supposed to cover their head around other men, not around the husband. In every society that promotes modesty for women, that's for the public, not for the husband. I mean, even the strict Islamic women, they're wearing their whole abaya in public, but that's not what they wear in their homes, or under their abayas. You've ever been to a shopping mall in a Muslim country. Let's see what they wear under their abayas in their own home. Basically, I understand it means that you're faithful to the person you marry. You're not having affairs. Not even emotional affairs. And that you're sexually modest, which is sort of the natural psychology of females, unless we're raised strangely. Most females are not, feel very uncomfortable to speak publicly or loosely about sexual matters, unlike males. Males are not like that. If you've ever noticed, they don't have that kind of reticence. They will speak very openly and grossly, at least to each other. But women aren't usually like that with each other. I mean, we can be trained to be like that. If you have a society that is trained to break down the natural modesty of women at a young age, it doesn't seem to be how we're wired. I have a theory about why that's true, if you're interested. I just see it as something biological, because we're the ones who have the babies. We have a lot more of an investment in who we have a sexual relationship. We have a much... Oh, is he supposed to leave? He's just copying something. I think they figure you're in the wrong place. I just see that women have much more of an investment, biologically speaking. You know, if you have a relationship with the wrong person, then you're left raising the child alone, right? So, because of that, women seem to be slower. We seem to have much more ability to say no than men do. intrusive and more shy to talk about such things. We're much slower to be aroused, to put it grossly. And we're not aroused as easily. Men are aroused just by sight from a distance. That's not generally true for women. So, you know, if somebody's very attracted to us and we think they're not suitable, we can say no. Marry me first. Of course, I don't know if anybody does that anymore, but that's the... That seems to be how we're physiologically and psychologically wired. And therefore, the studies are that married men are much more civilized than unmarried men. Having a girlfriend doesn't civilize a man, but having a wife does. Unmarried males are one of the main problems in the modern world. Yes? Mm-hmm. Just statistically speaking? Yes? That's what I understand that chastity means. Faithfulness and then keep retaining our natural, biological, physiological recitants and shyness, not messing with it, not breaking it. Modern society tries to break it. Am I correct about that? Mm-hmm. Yes.
In the same context, should I ask if it is necessary to put a ring to marry?
No. I mean, there you're talking about something cultural. It's interesting because, and you do have that other question. Which is already, I sort of already answered. When Prabhupada came first out of India, he was under the impression that in America, which is where he came, that there were no markers in dress as to marital status. You know, because in India, you could tell by looking at someone if they were married or not. And he didn't see that in the West, so he just said, you don't have this. But of course we do, we have wedding ring. But when, you know, but Prabhupada wasn't that familiar, that there was a different cultural marker. So, you know, in Bengal, the cultural marker is actually not so much the dot on the forehead, but the kumkum in the hair. And you'll see the traditional Bengali ladies, they'll wear the kumkum in the hair. In certain parts of India, it's wearing a certain necklace. It's wearing a Mangala Sutra necklace. So there's... I mean, I think most societies have some kind of marker. Is this person married? For obvious reasons. You know, for men also. I mean, it's just kind of helpful to know the status of who you're talking to, because you may deal with them a little differently, isn't it? As far as that other question, why is the emphasis on sense control for men? Because men don't have that natural shyness at all. Not at all. So men are only going to behave if they're thoroughly trained, whereas we tend to behave unless we're trained otherwise. By nature, we have a tendency to behave like that. Men certainly do not. So they require very explicit training in controlling their senses, which we really don't require. In modern society, maybe we do, because we're untrained, we're conditioned to be... both men and women should just be able to do anything and talk about anything. So we may need training in sense control. Is that okay?
In your class yesterday, you talked about when we come to our natural loving propensity to serve Krishna, and how our attachment to family and friends or relationships can sometimes reinforce unhelpful behaviours in ourselves, or like a self-identity that maybe we don't connect with anymore, as much to anymore. Mm. How can you manage that period of shift as you come to Krishna consciousness? How can you manage that period?
Oh, what a lovely question. With kindness to yourself, and with not blaming others for the fact that you're still shifting, because our disappointment with others is primarily because they're not acknowledging my false identity. That's my main disappointment. So if I understand that, then I can say, oh, my problem is that I'm trying to please the wrong person. I'm trying to work according to the wrong identity. I still have this problem. And that's the difficulty, and that way you can be much more forgiving and compassionate with other people as well. You may still have feelings of like, but it's a little bit easier to get some distance from them and say, well, those feelings are in my body and those feelings are in my mind, but they're the result of my wrong identity. Even if the other person did behave badly, I'm not exactly angry at them because of their bad behavior. I'm not exactly disappointed because of that. Because if I had the right identity, it wouldn't bother me so much. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Thank you. That was really thoughtful. Yes?
I have a question also about saying, you know, you're saying on your classes, I mean, it's different as well, how in the Shinabhagatam, Jyoti says, no, I don't want this woman to suffer the same way I have suffered. Just sort of develop that mentality you referred to, like, I don't want you to have like karmic reactions for the way you hurt me.
Correct.
And that's going to be really hard.
Is it hard to do that?
I find that there's some people that in my past have hurt me quite badly, and I'm just trying to come to the conclusion of, I don't want you to have a karmic reaction.
Well, I took a seminar on forgiveness where that's one step out of four. And it is difficult to do that without doing some previous steps. So that's kind of a sutra. That's just kind of a condensed, roofy version. So I don't have time to teach a whole seminar here. I have it online, but I'd say the first step when people hurt you is to go for what we call due process. Do you understand what that means? Just like in civilized countries of the world, there's, if you're accused of doing something wrong, you don't immediately go to jail. There's some sort of a court and there's witnesses, and, right? So just like sometimes people think that I hurt them, but they didn't hear my side of the story. Has it ever happened to you that way? The people are really mad at you, and they're upset with you, and they won't talk to you, they don't have anything to do with you, and they're completely misinterpreting what happened. Like, completely. I've had people just, they want anything to do with me, but their understanding of what happened is not anything that happened at all. And once they find out what actually happened, then they give up their bad feelings towards me. So it might work the other way too. It might be that someone who really hurt me, maybe I don't know their side of the story. So the first thing is always due process, to take the time if somebody has hurt us or disappointed us or cheated us or whatever, to find out what's going on and not just to assume that I'm 100% right and they're 100% wrong. This comes from accepting that I have imperfect senses. That's not just a philosophy about other people or conditioned souls. Conditioned souls have imperfect senses and cheat and make mistakes and are illusioned. But all my interpretations of my life are all completely true. So if I accept that I'm a conditioned soul and that I have those four defects, then what happens and my understanding of what happens is probably never exactly the same. Does that make sense to everybody? So I'm experiencing the world, but my experience of the world and the world are never absolutely identical. And my experience of how so-and-so hurt me and what that person actually did and what they were actually thinking is not going to be identical. So first is to find out, give the person the benefit of the doubt. You know, if it's a serious thing, then you let the police do that. You know, or some mediator or something. If it's not a serious thing and you're able to do that, then you do that. You go to the person and say, hey, you know, tell me your side of the story. which is a lot of what you talk about with the five drops. You know, drop the flame, drop the vein, right?
Yeah.
Which is that concept that you say, wait a minute, you know, do I really need to be this upset now? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm partially wrong. So that would be first step. And then if you are actually 100% right, or 90%, then the next thing is to get your needs met from Krishna, because our reason for being, again, I'm giving you a little synopsis here, our reason for being upset and angry is we're trying to get some needs met, and our reason for wanting the other person to suffer, we're trying to create balance and justice in the universe, or we want empathy from that person. If you suffer as much as I've suffered, maybe you'll be empathetic, maybe we'll connect again. Or maybe I'm just trying to justify my rightness, because if I suffer and you're happy, then it's hard to say that I'm right and you're wrong, because we have an innate sense that good people are happy and bad people suffer. Especially if you don't suffer for hurting me, then that must mean you didn't really hurt me. You have just something like that. Maybe some kind of envy. I don't want anyone to be attacked, to be happier than me, especially if they cause me pain. You know, what's our real motive for wanting those who hurt us to suffer? And for the things that are good, that we want justice, that we want empathy, that we want balance, you know, for that we go to Krishna, we get that from Krishna. Because I can't really get that from the other person anyway, frankly. They don't have it to give. Even if someone's always nice to me, they can't fulfill all my needs for justice and harmony and empathy and love and balance, and that. They just can't. They're just a little tiny jiva. So I get that from Krishna. Then I can say, may you learn through joy. And the fourth step is saying to Krishna, okay, what was my lesson in all this? Why did you allow this to happen to me? Why did you allow this person to be the agent of suffering for me? What do you want me to get out of? But yeah, if we're not getting our needs met from Krishna, then it's very hard to wish joy to our enemies. Is that all right? That's a little bit bigger synopsis, but still synopsis. Yeah.
Would you guys think about forgiveness and resentment and how it's necessary to move forward from that, release the resentment and
well, it's just, if I want the people who hurt me to suffer, if that's what I want, then I'm entangling myself in karma. Because Dhruva's mother told him that anything you desire for others, you will experience. So if you desire harm to others, you will experience harm, and you set up a cycle. You hurt them, they hurt you, you hurt them, they hurt you, you hurt them, they hurt you, and it can go on for many, many lifetimes. You can become the person's parent or child or spouse or sibling or whatever, just so you get an opportunity to hurt them back. And it can go on for generations, and people are still fighting and they don't even know why. My great-great-great-great-grandfather offended your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, so pow, 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 I'm going to pull your head off. Yes? Isn't it? A lot of these people were fighting. They don't know why you're fighting. 100 years ago, your great-grandfather took land from my great-grandfather. I mean, how silly. Okay, let's can we go on from now, folks? You know, but now, and there's war, and there's... We're looking for safety, we're looking for justice, we're looking for balance, we're looking for connection. We're not going to find that by hurting those who hurt us, or desiring hurt for those who hurt us. Do we find that in that way? Does that work? By hurting those who hurt us, or wanting hurt for those who hurt us, do we find connection, empathy, justice, balance, and safety? Does that work for anybody? to want to find safety and justice and balance and empathy. That's all good spiritual things, but that's not the way to find them. So we should want those who hurt us to learn that they shouldn't hurt people for their own good. But another thing is, if I want people to learn through suffering, then guess how I'm going to learn it? Because what I want for others boomerangs back to me. So if I want other people to learn through suffering, then I will learn through suffering. Anybody here like learning through suffering? I got a few people who said, yeah, it's good to learn through suffering. Okay, fine. You can have it if you want. So if we want to learn joyfully, right? Would we like to learn joyfully? Yes? Wish joyful learning to those who harm you. It's one of the most effective ways for your life lessons to become joyful. Two effective ways to make your life lessons joyful. When Krishna tries to teach you through joy, listen. So he doesn't have to shout. Because he never shouts first. And the other thing is, wish joyful lessons on those who harm you. Wish joyful lessons to everybody. Well, that's easy for your friends. You know? Wish joyful lessons for those who harm you, and then that's what you'll get. Is that right? Again, you're asking me to like really summarize a whole class that I give. Yes?
So briefly, you just mentioned the word desires, and it made me think about how coming into Krishna consciousness, and I suppose actually maybe for everyone, there's always these desires that I think are stemming from greed and lust and all of those kind of, the roots, basically.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, do you have any advice on what to do about them and how to know which ones are the ropes or which ones are, I don't know, Krishna conscious, or which ones are you need to listen to, which ones you need to kind of ask for support from Krishna to help them go away for the time?
Yeah, there's a really nice description at the end of Bhagavad Gita of the modes of nature and how one gets clarity according to the modes. So the mode of ignorance is something like, you know, one of these thick curtains where you really can't see outside at all. And the mode of passion is kind of like the windows with rain all over it. And the mode of goodness is like a clear window, and the bhakti is like you're outside. So the more we're covered by the modes, the less we're able to have this kind of discretion. All right, what's my actual motive here? Which desires do I need to fulfill in Krishna's service? Which desires are just rubbish and I've got to just get rid of them? You know, what's motivating me? Where are my desires coming from? Are they coming from something spiritual? Are they coming from something material? How do I deal with them? Instead of asking those questions, change your consciousness and then the answers become obvious to you. You'll see them yourself. Like Krishna says, when you're Krishna conscious, it's like the sun that lights up everything in the daytime. As we move our consciousness to a clearer and clearer place, then you just go, oh, and you see it yourself. You all have this experience? So the more we come out of a covered state, the more these things become clear. Krishna says the mode of ignorance, you can't tell what's to be done, what's binding, what's liberating. You're just confused. You're just kind of working blindly. And in the mode of passion, he says, sometimes you can see and sometimes you can't. Just like, you know, I can see some things through the window like that, but I can't see. It's kind of fuzzy. And the mode of goodness, he says, you can see what's binding, what's liberating, what's to be done, what's not to be done. You can distinguish what's dharma and what's adharma. And you can start seeing your motives. I want to speak of when you actually come to bhakti. When you come to bhakti, things become very clear. So this is the main way. Because otherwise, if you talk about criteria, if we're covered by the modes, we won't even be able to apply the criteria very well. But I can give you some criteria. But definitely, if you're in the mode of ignorance, you want to apply the criteria properly. So the first criteria is you look at guru, sadhu, and shastra. What does it say in the scriptures? What do the saints actually do? What is my guru or gurus, what do they instruct me? But, I mean, the Christians have a saying, the devil quotes scripture. And Prabhupada would also say this. You can find something in the scripture to justify almost anything. And you could find some saintly person's behavior to justify almost anything, too. And you could find something that Srila Prabhupada said to somebody, somewhere. I mean, it's amazing to me how strange, what strange conclusions people can come up with, even though they're ostensibly Hare Krishna devotees. Sometimes I'm astonished. How in the world did you get that conclusion? But the first criteria is Guru Sadhu Shastra. Is this a desire that is sanctioned in the Shastra? You follow what I'm saying? Is it a desire that's not sanctioned in the Shastra? How does the Shastra categorize this desire? What do the saintly persons do with this desire? What kind of advice does my spiritual master give regarding this desire? And then the next criteria is, how do I feel? Which is, by the way, not at all unimportant. It's subordinate, but it's not unimportant. And this is from Bhagavad Gita 9.2. Raja Vidya Raja Vriyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Prachaksha Vagamam Dharmam Su Sukham Kartanam. So, Raja Vidya, it's you have knowledge, you have understanding, you have realization, you go, oh, everything makes sense. You don't feel bewildered. When you're doing the right thing, you don't feel bewildered, you don't feel confused. Raja Gunyam, you understand that you've gotten the essence of things. You can feel that, oh, I've gotten to the essence of things, I've gotten real understanding. Pavitram, you feel very purified. Prachaksha, you experience it directly. Dharma, it's authentic. It's like the difference between, you know, an organically grown, fresh off the tree, tree-ripened orange, and some orange-flavored, sugar-laden water. Susukam fills you with happiness, with real joy. So when we understand things correctly, according to Guru Sadhana Shastra, that will be the subjective result. If we're not getting that subjective result, guarantee you we're not understanding Guru Sadhana Shastra properly. Absolutely, positively guaranteed. If someone says, I'm following Guru Sadhu Shastra, and they're agitated, and they're angry, and they're not peaceful, and they don't feel purified, and they're confused, 100% they're not understanding Guru Sadhu Shastra. Because it will have that result. But again, you could start understanding Guru Sadhu Shastra, and you could really misinterpret it. And if you're in the modes, you don't even have, if you're in the lower modes, you don't even have a sense of whether or not you're joyful in your heart. You don't even know what that means. You follow? People who are mostly in the mode of ignorance, if you say your heart full of peace and joy, they're just like, yeah, man, I'm cool. They don't even know what you're talking about. They don't even know what that sensation is. That sensation of peace and joy and harmony that comes from. Does that answer your question? May not be answered. Does that answer your question?
That's really helpful. Sorry. Sorry to overstate your question. So if that's still nagging at us, we can't find anything in the readings, is it better to talk with someone?
First thing to do, always, is to adjust your consciousness. Always. Prabhupada gives the example, and it's interesting because I recently found out that this example is given in every tradition that teaches contemplation and meditation. He says, if you're very disturbed, it's like a pond where the mud has been stirred up. He said, you have to let things settle and let the mud go to the bottom so the water is clear. And he said, just stop everything, sit down and chant. Now, of course, if you're sitting down and chanting, but you're not actually chanting, because your mind is racing with all the things that are bothering you? Do you understand? So if you're just, if your mouth is going Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, but your mind and your heart is in a different atmosphere, maybe you need to do something else to clear your consciousness. Maybe you have to really get into some service project. But you need to clear consciousness. You need to come to a point where the mind goes to its default value of sattva. Our mind is a product of the world of goodness. And our mind's natural factory installed state is sattva gun. So we need to do something that puts our mind in sattva gun. Or in bhakti. Krishna says in the 11th canto, if you're not self-realized, then you need more goodness. At least sattva. At least sattva, you've got a clear window. At least that. Better is if you can actually come to bhakti. For someone that's going to be picking up the Bhagavatam, for someone that's going to be sitting down with their japa beads, for someone that's going to be getting out their harmonium, for someone that's going to be going out and preaching. Do you follow? We all know which activities in bhakti just make the mind go, and we get focused again. You follow? First, that. Because if you don't do that first, if you don't get in the proper consciousness first, we can't understand Guru Sadhu Shastramana anymore. It doesn't work. Now, maybe hearing from Guru is what fixes your mind. Maybe talking to devotees is what fixes your mind. Maybe reading the Shastras is what fixes your mind. But I can't hear properly if I'm not... Yes? Don't we all have this experience also if I'm talking to somebody else? Have you ever tried to help somebody else whose mind was so disturbed that you couldn't help them? And it didn't matter what you said, it didn't matter what you did because their mind was so disturbed. And you just have to say, it's okay, it's okay. So always that first. Apurva something. Apurva Madhuri, is that right?
Okay, this is quite open-ended, so please feel free to answer it in any way that you like. I'd just like to know your opinion on whether you feel that there is a glass ceiling for women in ISKCON, and whether we can or should be, if there is, whether we can or should be trying to...
break it. ISKCON is a very big, multifaceted organization. It is not a monolithic organization. And you can define ISKCON in many different ways. What does it mean? Does it mean the properties that are in the legal name of the society? Does it mean the 30 or so people who meet in Mayapur as the GBC? Does it mean anybody who is aligning themselves with ISKCON, which would be, I assume, most of the people in this room? You know, what does it mean? Does it mean the person who looks at me from the mirror? Is that this one? So, it really... How women are treated and whether or not there's a glass ceiling for women really depends what part of this country you're in and what you're doing and where you are. So, in a lot of places, the answer to that is no. There isn't any. Well, there's still one or two, actually, everywhere. And some places, oh my God, it's really thick and it's really low. And it's just suffocating. I just don't even go. It's too thick, it's too low, and I can't even dent it or crack it, and I just stay right there.
In most places, it's somewhere in the middle.
There's a few things everywhere in ISKCON that are still possible for you. Just a few, not many. Two or three things. Yeah, any place that's part of ISKCON, that's a fact. Shouldn't you try to break it? It depends who you are, why you want to break it. Do you want to break it because you think you're a woman? And you want women's rights in the Hare Krishna movement? Then I suggest you go chant Hare Krishna and do something else. If you want to break it because you're understanding that there's things against what Srila Prabhupada wanted, and that breaking it would be helpful for the preaching, yes, but proceed with caution because a broken glass is a little dangerous. And always be careful of your own motives and things like that. How to break it? Interesting question. I don't think there's one answer to that. It depends where you are, what the glass ceiling is about, who you are, what your relationships are with people, how you, what your method is. But always with humility and never with bodily identification. Don't make things political. If you make things political, then you're as much part of the problem as what you want to solve. Being political on the other side of the politics doesn't make you not political. If you're shooting guns, does it really matter which side of the line you're on shooting the guns? You know, you still get the bullets in your arm. It would be very good. And for some of us, you know, we may say, hey, if I go that way, immediately got to get into politics and bodily identification, so better somebody else do it. So you've got to, you've always got to be gauging subjectively that if I deal, however you may deal with it in a particular place, is it helping me to think of Krishna more or not? If it's driving that beautiful bluish blackish boy with his fruit and cows out of your consciousness, stop and run the other way. If it's increasing it, then keep going. It's delicate.
I'm speaking from it. Yeah. Hare Krishna. I don't quite know how to frame this question, but from my conditioning, I feel that if I'm not burning myself, if I'm not burning myself out of Krishna's service, then I'm not doing enough. Or that I'm being lazy. So I don't quite know how to strike the balance between being a superwoman and...
If somebody was burning themselves out to make you happy, would you like that?
Depends on who it is.
Someone you didn't like very much, I'd say. If it's someone that you care about, there are people in your life that you care about. Pick one of them. Pick one that you care about a lot. Would you like that person to burn themselves out in order to make you happy? What kind of a God do you think Krishna is? What kind of person do you think he is? So if we feel that way, it will really impede our loving him and surrendering to him because we won't think he's a very nice guy. We'll think that what he's asking in terms of surrender is harming ourselves. And that will be a block in our being able to give ourselves to him. He wants you whole. He doesn't want you burnt. He wants you fully yourself and whole. And vibrant. And energized. And he wants a relationship on that basis. Any sacrifices you make should energize you. That doesn't mean that they may, you know, you may become physically exhausted sometimes and so on. It's just like you have a body has to sleep. But you should feel energized and enlivened, or you're doing something really radically wrong. Prabhupada says, first step is joyfulness. He said, if you're not joyful, you're not. He said, it's really heavy. He said, you're just a pretender. You're not feeling joyful. you know, you read that and you go, oh my. What we do want to burn out is the not me. We want to burn out the disease. We should rejoice at seeing the false ego and the pride and the lust and the envy and the anger and the, I'm always right and I'm the center of the universe, and that can all burn. And when that burns, what should be left is joy and exuberance and energy. Krishna says to relish and rejoice in the self. Is that all right? Yes.
I think Krishna has put in front of us an opportunity for us to stretch and grow and get out of our comfort zone, or if it's just kind of a distraction in our sort of more stable looking at Krishna conscious life.
Very similar answer to what I gave her. We have to have the consciousness to be able to discriminate properly. Is it Guru's body and Shastra? Is it okay? Or would I be stretching and growing beyond the boundary of Guru's body and Shastra? And then how do I feel? If my consciousness is okay, if I'm not agitated and disturbed, and if it's within the boundaries of Guru Sadhu Shastra, and I try to do it, and I actually grow, and I expand, and I'm alive, and great. If I try to do it, and, it's a catastrophe, and I come back. You say, wait, this is not... Sometimes things come up, and you try a little bit, and then you say, whoa, where's Krishna? Is it helping you think of Krishna more? Is it helping you be kinder to yourself and to other living entities? He follows. What's the result? Prabhupada always said, you judge by the result. Jesus said, you judge a tree by its fruits. What's your result? So that's subjective. You make sure you get the objective first. But the subjective is also there. It's not. Prabhupada would say, you don't need a certificate from anyone else to know whether or not you're progressing in Krishna consciousness. So just like when we're eating. So I had a funny thing yesterday that she made the devotee who cooked for Maharaj yesterday. Mm-hmm. She's here. She's not. So Bhakti Maharaj was supposed to bring me lunch yesterday, and I got a note in my room. I'll have lunch there at 3. So I was there, it was about 2:30. 2:40, 2:45, and the cook from Mara said, I have leftover prasadam, would you like it? Well, I don't know, maybe Bhakti Mara's going to be really mad at me if I were to eat first. So she brought, it wasn't that much for quantity prasadam. It was a very small quantity. But I don't know, I mean, it must have been filled with bhakti. I mean, I can't explain it. And it was very light, it was nothing heavy. It was a small quantity, and it was nothing heavy. And I ate that one little plate, and I said, I'm completely satisfied. What am I going to do with Bhakti Marta? So Prabhupada says, we all know if we're satisfied. We don't need to take a certificate from others. I didn't have to say, did I eat enough? Unless we have some kind of strange medical condition, we all know, am I satisfied? He said, in the same way, if you become Krishna conscious, you become purified, you become joyful. You see things in the proper perspective. And Prabhupada says, if you say I'm doing Krishna consciousness and that's not happening, then either you're actually not doing Krishna consciousness. Like you're just chewing gum instead of eating. Or there's parasites taking the nutrition, which means we're doing offenses. So either I'm not doing real Krishna consciousness. Maybe I'm doing mixed bhakti, or maybe I'm doing something that's not bhakti at all. In the name of bhakti. And if I'm doing unmixed bhakti, then maybe I'm committing some sort of offenses. Let's see, how does it? And then have the intelligence to adjust. And you also have your authorities, you know, if you have a husband, if you have a father, if you have a guru, you can also ask, is this a good opportunity for me? You know, I had someone write me an email the other day. I was invited to do such and such service, what do you think? And I pretty much wrote back and said, no. I said, this is a really bad fit. This is not going to work for you. And then he wrote back and said, I knew that actually from the beginning. Kind of obvious. Oh, you know, you can ask somebody else. The problem with asking people is everybody has their own opinion. Someone said to me the other day, I heard you should ask three brahmanas. I'm like, why does it say that in the Shastra? So that's not always. But it may be very happy, it may be very helpful to consult with sadhus. What do other sadhus do? See, often what we want to know is, what should I do? But you'll know what to do if you have the proper consciousness. You'll just know what to do. It becomes obvious. So always go there first. Is that okay? Yes?
Yesterday you were talking about the four stages of competence.
Oh yeah, that's a teaching. That's not Shastra, that's education.
Yeah, it's something about education. So that you said that the conscious incompetence?
Yeah, first unconscious incompetence,
yeah.
Then conscious incompetence, then conscious competence, then unconscious competence.
Yeah, so the...
That's hard for you to write on.
So conscious incompetence, you said that's the most difficult because you can see that you're doing something that's not benefiting you, but you can't not look like some negative habit or way you're associated with people or something like that, or false pride that's driving those kind of interface. So how can you make that jump or transition into the third stage, what you can kind of embrace that honest intrinsic?
Well, it's really Krishna that does that for you. It's not exactly that you do that yourself. Although that is the process of sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti is conscious competence. That's what it is. Bhava bhakti and prema bhakti are unconscious competence. It's automatic. I mean, unconscious is kind of a bad word. It's not quite the right word. As I say, those are educational terms. It's automatic. You automatically do. It's not that the devotees in prema are like, oh yeah, I need to chant Java. They just naturally are always doing the right thing. So sadhana bhakti, the angas of bhakti, is the system of conscious competence. Do these things, don't do these things in this way, avoid these things in this way. That's what it is. And as we become aware of things, then when we become aware of something and we really become aware of it, then Krishna removes it. And really become aware of it means understanding how we're trying to enjoy that negative, which is why I talked about from negative devotion, that everyone's looking for lust. If we just look at a bad habit and say, I don't really, which is what Arjuna said, I don't really want to do these things, but I'm being forced to do them against my will, which is what it feels like in conscious incompetence. And Krishna said, well, that's not actually true. You're not really being forced to do these things against your will. You're actually doing these things because you are trying to enjoy something. You have a certain kind of lust to enjoy in a particular way. And that lust to enjoy in a particular way pushes you to do these things that you know are wrong. So go to that. Going to that requires a lot of courage and humility. Because it's very different to say, oh, I didn't mean to do that, I'm sorry, to, yeah, I meant to do that because I wanted to enjoy hurting you. it's a big difference between those two things. You know, oh, well, I'm just eating meat because that's how my parents trained me, and to, wow, I know that I'm eating a dead animal. Something I don't know. And I am taking pleasure, I am intentionally, knowingly taking pleasure in the suffering of a helpless, innocent being.
Whoa.
Who wants to see that? Who wants to look in the mirror and say, I am getting pleasure for being the agent for the extreme suffering of a helpless, innocent being? Anybody want to look in the mirror and see that? But that's exactly what meat eating is, isn't it? Isn't it? Am I correct? Yes. But no, who wants to see that? So that's exactly what we need to see with all of our material attachments. We need to be willing to see that. I am knowingly, intentionally enjoying something that is harming myself, ultimately only myself. I really can't harm anybody else, really. I can be the agent for someone else's harm, but I can only be the agent for the harm of someone else that they have coming by their karma. So I can't exactly harm them. And I can't really harm God. But I can harm myself, who's a part of God. Once we see that, then immediately you want to not do it anymore. And as soon as you really don't want to do it anymore, Krishna removes it. It's just gone. The push to do that thing is just vaporizes. Just gone. And if an opportunity to do the thing comes in front of you, you just like, no way. There's no happiness in that. But it's not a pleasurable thing. It's like, no. It's not pleasurable at all. Does that make sense?
On a more subtle level, like you noticed, it was a the TikTok example, but the lady in the high end, like looking for honor or prestige or recognition, things like that. So you know that that's not.
But again, it's coming to the point where we're willing to see it, where we're willing to look at it and go, what am I trying to enjoy? Wow, what is this thing I'm trying to enjoy? What is it actually? What is its real nature? As Prabhupada said, to see the naked form of material desires. So generally those things get shown to us gradually, because if they were shown all at once, we would just be like... So generally Krishna shows it to us gradually as we're willing to accept it. If you're not willing to see that stuff at all, then you don't really enter into higher realms of bhakti. You just can't. Because that's the stuff that's covering the soul. You can't realize the self and experience those realms if you have all this stuff on you. Willing to look at that and hear it. But it's a relief, you know. Like, that's good. You know, we were so afraid. If I look in the mirror and see, I'll just be so depressed with how evil I am. Yeah, I'm okay for a minute or two. That's true. But then it's gone. And then you're like, wow. I was really evil, wasn't I? Woo! Wow, Krishna's really kind. That's fine. Yes, makes sense. Did you have a question? Because then I go.
Well, it may not be very applicable to other people, but for myself.
Okay.
I've experienced, because it's said that a wife, could be submissive to her husband, right? Or
could be.
Should be.
Could be.
Or, you know, it's very debatable. But in my experience, I've found that I need to learn to not be submissive, but to be assertive. So I'm just wondering if you could say anything about that, because obviously... In any relationship, but women, most women here are either wives or they will be wives, and even in other relationships...
All I can say is that when I first read Prabhupada talking about women being submissive to their husbands, I, as a good devotee, really tried to do that, but I didn't have the foggiest notion of what I was doing. I didn't have any good model. I mean, my mother tried to be a good wife, but she wasn't a very good model in that regard. And my sister, I didn't really know enough of how my sisters dealt with their husbands to have them as a model if they were good models. I didn't really know what that meant. And so I ended up doing things that were rather silly in retrospect. And there was a book passed around secretly among the devotees in the 70s called Fascinating Womanhood, secretly because you could only read Srila Prabhupada's books. Anything else was money. It's like, there's a book about how to be a good wife. It was written by a Christian lady, and she gave...
It's still going around.
It really is. I mean, there's some things she doesn't cover, some areas that she doesn't discuss. But I thought everything that was there was great. And after reading that, I found that it was much more helpful because she was very specific. You know, what does it mean? Why should women be submissive to their husbands, and in what way? So my guess is that you were doing a kind of parody of submission. Because anything that's a right, I'm going to go back to the same theme, anything that's a right and a good thing and that's in harmony with Krishna brings good results. You know, and the submissive women of the Shastra were sometimes pretty assertive. Gandhari, she made very clear to Dhritarashtra that you shouldn't be fighting this war, this is wrong. I mean, Maharaj brought up about Vindavali, that she corrected her husband publicly in front of Lord Brahma. That was pretty assertive. And Mandodari, I mean, she had been saying to Ravana all along, give Sita back. I mean, then, of course, he was dead, but even then she said, you know, you've made your body fit to be eaten by vultures and your soul fit to go to hell. That was pretty assertive. She loved him, but she condemned what he did. She didn't submit to what he was doing. And, you know, Draupadi was literally fiery. She was born from fire. The concept that submission in a woman means that she should be mousy, you know, we have a lot of trouble with a lot of the Vedic women because Draupadi was not mousy. I mean, there's nothing wrong with women who are naturally very reserved. Some women and some men are naturally very reserved, and some women and some men are naturally very outgoing. Neither is good or bad. Neither is more spiritual than the other. It's not that all men have to be outgoing and all women have to be reserved. That's nonsense. And isn't it real? And anyway, Krishna says you can't change your nature. He says it. If you have a feisty, assertive, outgoing nature, well, guess what? You have a feisty, assertive, outgoing nature. If you waste your time trying to have a reserved back-of-the-room nature, well, just take another birth so you can have a reserved back-of-the-room nature and try to have the next life. And the same if you've got a reserved back-of-the-room nature and you think, God, I wish I could be more outgoing and assertive. Then you have to take another birth to do that. It doesn't matter. The point is, whatever nature you have, use it to please Krishna. What I understand about submission mostly is understanding that for the man to be inspired to protect and take care of a woman, he has to feel that he's the boss. If he doesn't feel that he's the boss, he's not going to be inspired. Men have a very different reason for a long-term relationship with a woman than women have for a long-term relationship with a man, speaking just biologically. Very different. Again, because we're a women have babies. So we have a very clear external tangible need to have the father of our child involved long term in our life. A man does not have that. He really doesn't. He doesn't have that same chemical, biological, psychological need to have a long term involvement with the mother of his child. Doesn't. So why is he going to hang around? He's going to hang around if he feels like he's being a hero for him. It doesn't matter, folks. It just doesn't matter. It's all mundane. It's all material. Just who cares? It just doesn't matter. It's just a role we're playing in this life. And if you don't like it, you can try another role in another life. No, it just doesn't matter. He's so hung up as, well, I don't like the role that I'm playing in this life. I like the role that person. Get real. It's just a role. It's just one life. We've done everything. If you don't think you've done anything, stick around. You can have unlimited opportunities. But if a man doesn't feel like a hero and he doesn't feel like he's needed, and he doesn't feel like he's directing things, it's going to be very hard for most males to stick with him. Just what it is. So that's an art. And if the woman doesn't feel that the man's attracted to her, it's hard for her to stick with him. It's a similar stupidity. You know, if the man says to his wife, you know, there's lots of better looking women than you. I mean, this is so stupid. Of course there's lots of better looking women. It's just a statement of fact. But she's not going to receive it that way. You know, and if you say to the husband, you know, you're my hero, is that true? Of course not. Stupid. But if he doesn't think that you feel that way, then he doesn't have the impetus to say it. It just... So just like, it's really like you say, okay, Krishna's given me this particular service, and let me do it nicely. Does that make sense? It's like if you're speaking about Krishna consciousness to somebody first day in the door, and you're speaking about Krishna consciousness to somebody 20 years in the door, you can speak differently. And you don't say, why can't I talk to the first day person and just tell them everything right now as it is? Because you're burning them out. I have this particular costume. Let me do it for Krishna. That's what I understand submissiveness means. It means that I respect the fact that a soul in a male human form has a particular psychology that I would do best to honor. If I want Krishna to be pleased by my service. It doesn't mean I have to agree with everything he says. It doesn't mean I have to be a doormat. It doesn't mean I have to be a little mouse. That's just dumb. It's an unattainable, dumb thing that will make you miserable. But you know, this is a big topic. This is a week-long... in-depth seminar. What are the psychologies of men and women? How should they relate to each other? Which is very worthwhile knowing and studying, but ultimately, it's just a game. All that really is okay, what role do I have in the drama right now? And what's my lines, and what's my part, and how do I play the role well for the pleasure of the audience who's Krishna? And our main business in life is not understanding male-female psychology and how to get along between the genders. That is a very minor part of life, actually. We should know how to do it, just like we should know how to brush our teeth, and we should know how to put on our socks. But that's not the goal of life. goal of life is to follow Lord Krishna. Is that okay? Long, complicated answer. Alright, I have to go. I'm late. Hare Krishna.
Thank you so much.
Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.